We will kick off the meeting now, 6 minutes past. I hope those who are joining by various audio means will be able to get on soon. Thank you all for coming along to the fifth meeting of Working Party One of the Accountability CCWG. This is our last meeting before our face-to-face meeting in Istanbul. The agenda that I've proposed is a quick look at anything we need to focus on from the CCWG call yesterday that isn't on the agenda already, and then chunking through quite a lot of substantive content. We want to look again at the stuff that Matthew circulated earlier this week. We want to look at the options that Malcolm Hubby circulated regarding removing the ICAM board. There's one that's coming from Steve Del Bianco on 3A, which just at the moment escapes me. I'm suffering a bad cold, so I apologize for that. But we'll do that in the powers section. And then we need to look through the mechanisms structures, where I've circulated some drafts earlier today. I apologize for the lateness of those, and where statutory delegates and members have also been circulated and available. So that'll be the bulk of this call. I'll spend a little bit of time at the end thinking about what we want to do on Sunday in Istanbul for those who are able to attend, and then look at any other business. Are there any items that we need to deal with in this call that aren't on that agenda? Kabus, I see that your hand is up here. I think, though, that you don't have audio access from what's happening in the chat, so I hope that you do soon. We can't delay the meeting for one person's availability, unfortunately, but I hope that we can get through to him soon. So, arriving from the CWG meeting, are there any items that people would like to raise? I'm just trying to find the formal note that was circulated on the 18th. The key point is to make sure that the circulated call for any other item at Istanbul is covered, and I think that all of our main items are covered. There are power mechanisms and the incorporation of the AOC into the bylaws. Those are all on the agenda already. I raised, as was asked at this last meeting, the issue of jurisdiction, and would have seen some email traffic about that on the main CCWG list. So I think we can chug through. I'm looking forward to hearing personally who the lawyers appointed and working out a schedule for there. I think it's also worth noting that the actual viability of the entire schedule of the Workstream 1 work has been raised, we will come to that at Istanbul, so we don't need to discuss it here. I think that everyone understands the need for a realistic timetable that is actually workable, so I don't think we'll have any problems arriving at a view about what that is after we've had our discussions in Istanbul. The point is to do as much work as we can there. So are there other items to raise? I see a hand up from Malcolm. Malcolm, far away.
Jordan, thank you. And I'm afraid this is a meta point, and it's only a small thing, but the Istanbul meeting was listed and advertised as being for Monday and Tuesday, and it turns out that we're going to be having meetings on Sunday afternoon as well, which means that I'm going to have to burn some flight tickets in order to make it for the Sunday afternoon meeting. So I would ask the staff if they're aware that preliminary meetings are going to happen for such meetings, that they also note those on calendars and announcements and so forth. Thank you.
Thanks, Malcolm. The way we've discussed this prior meeting in all communications is that it will be an informal one with no decision-making. So it was first flagged a couple of weeks ago. I think it would be very helpful if staff do flag that stuff in calendars in future, and we'll make sure that if we feel like we need such a meeting in advance of our next face-to-face, we sort that out earlier. So it's a point well made, but I don't know if we'll be covering anything at that meeting that would demand you burning up tickets and change your arrangements particularly. But we might know more about that when we discuss it at the end of this call. So point well made, thank you. Matthew, you've got your hand up as well.
Yes, thanks, Jordan. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you fine, yep.
Okay, great. So one issue that I raised on the list, and perhaps it's something that we may need to start considering relatively soon, and perhaps we could start in Istanbul, is assuming that these various accountability measures proceed, what is the actual implementation timeline? In other words, how do we ensure that we have the time to account for the various processes that they will need to go through to be approved by the target date of July or September or whatever it may be for the accountability submission to NTIA? And what process is there? That was exciting. Anyway, so what process is there for ensuring that we have the time and the mechanisms in place to do that? Thanks.
Thanks, Matthew. That's a good point, and I'm assuming that that will form part of the discussion in Istanbul when we come to scheduling as well, because not only is there the time frames for actually being able to establish a community, an accountability process that has had appropriate levels of community input and feedback, there's also the point that we have to be able to implement it, and that has to be done with cognizance of the names community proposal and also the protocols and parameters numbers proposals. So I'm reasonably confident that no one's expecting us to implement all the Workstream 1 stuff in time for July, but I know that in my mind at least we'll have to have a workable way to implement it all before the NTIA contract expires, whenever that is. So it's a point, again, well made, that will be definitely on the agenda in a sense. Thanks. Carlos, your hand is up.
Yes, good time to everybody. I understand that you said that on July something will be submitted on the accountability to NTIA. I think, first of all, if it is something that is related merely and solely for the Workers Team 1, but not for the Workers Team 2. This is number one. Number two, as I understand correctly from our charter, CCWG would not send anything to NTIA. It would send something to the ICANN. Am I right or wrong? Thank you.
You're right, Caboos, on the second one, and you're wrong, I think, on the first one. In respect of when we have to submit our Workstream 1 proposal, I'm pretty confident the timeline has it going to SOs and ACs for sign-off in June, in time for the ICANN board to receive it following that endorsement from SOs and ACs for discussion prior to the Buenos Aires meeting at the end of June. So that's the schedule we will have to decide in Istanbul whether we can manage or not. But you are right on the second point. Our job is to submit our proposal to the ICANN board, which has given all sorts of assurances that it will faithfully pass that on to NTIA. So thanks for raising those two issues. I hope that clarifies it. Okay. Are there any other matters to raise from the CCWG meeting? I don't want to get bogged down in a discussion about the timetable now. I think maybe we can come back to that at the end of the call in any other business. I think that it's going to be challenging at best to do what we're doing, given that we're up with the legal advice. So let's just hold that till we've dealt with our substantive stuff, if we could. which I'd now like to move on to. This is item 3 in the agenda, and we've got two people in the agenda listed, Matthew Shears to talk about ALC incorporation, Malcolm Huddy to talk about removing the ICANN board, his varieties, Steve Dabianco with his 3A that I keep forgetting the name of. Just before we do that, since we've got it in front of us, we should look just quickly through the work status chart. I'm going to assume that you all have a navigation mode available to that, so I'm not going to be centrally controlling what you see. If you scroll down to the second page of that sheet, you've got the powers list. You've got the green ones at the top. You've got yellow draft ones in bar 2. We have talked those through a number of times. When you get down to the first red one, 3A, that's the one that Steve has started and we'll be discussing later in this call, being able to require the implementation of all accountability workstream 2 issues post-transition. We've already said that the GAC stuff is a bit on hold, and I don't doubt that will be a subject at the assemble meeting. I know that Keith Jarzak has done some work on the obligations stuff, and I, for the life of me, cannot remember whether we discussed it at the last meeting. So, Keith, I think you're on the call. I think that you'll be ready to take us through it on this call. If you could confirm that. Good. So we will discuss that one as well. So, Keith and Steve, as well as the two names that are already there on the agenda for Powers Matters. We aren't starting the Ombudsman stuff because it's Workstream 2, and we have got a draft that's been quite well discussed on directories. So in my mind, despite the fact those are there's a variety of colors there of green, yellow, and red, they're actually all of the ones that need to be green or yellow are or can be green and yellow. And we will get to that. Sorry, in terms of the line being choppy when I'm talking, I'll try and hold the microphone closer to my face, and I'll try to speak a little bit more slowly. Then if you scroll down to our table 2, our mechanisms table, as of this morning, we do have drafts for all of these mechanisms, SOAC structures, permanent CCWG, delegates, members, supervisory board, and community veto. They will all have been discussed a first time, at least at the end of this call. So by my reckoning, we're largely on track after this call. If anyone has any other status items to raise, could they either just do so briefly now or save them for the end of this section of the agenda. So I'll do another call about whether there's any other status updates at the end of this item 3. And in the meantime, why don't we go in this order for these. We'll get Matthew to talk about ALC incorporation. We'll get Malcolm to talk about his variants of the board. We'll get Steve to talk about his 3A stuff. And we'll get Keith to talk about his 5B stuff. So that's the order. Matthew, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Jordan. So just to remind everybody that this is to address the other articles in the affirmation of commitments beyond those that were dealt with by Steve previously relating to the various So the document you have on your screen at the moment is a slightly revised version of the document that was circulated, I think, 2 weeks ago now. I sent it out to the WP1 list, I think it was Monday, and Jordan sent it again, so you should have copies in your inboxes. So what I've done here is I've tried to summarize our discussion that we had the last time round, as well as incorporate comments and text edits from Steve and Robin. And what we're looking at here basically is a proposal for 2 new core values in the bylaws, an edit to one of the core values, and a proposal for 2 new paragraphs in Article 3 on transparency. And this is this document, what's in red in the document, reflects those new proposals based upon, as I said, the inputs that I've had so far. What I will say is that it's very, very important that those of you who have not commented on this document do so, because these are pretty important changes that are being proposed here, and the more input, the better. So just to walk through, so paragraph 3 of the article, the affirmation of commitments, includes text that talks about ensuring that decisions are made related to the global technical coordination of the DNS are made in the public interest and are accountable and transparent. In the particular, in the core values of the bylaws, this text is this, the idea and the intent behind this text is not explicit. So the proposal, including edit from Robin, is that we ask or seek a new core value in the bylaws that would read, ensure that decisions made related to the global technical coordination of the DNS are made in the global public interest and are accountable, transparent, and bottom-up in their formulation. So that's the first proposal in red that you can see on that page. If you just scroll down a little bit, you will see the second one, which is an edit to the existing core value 5, where one of the things that's in the affirmation of commitments talks about promoting competition, consumer trust, and consumer choice in the DNS marketplace. The notion of competition is in the bylaws, but not the notions of consumer trust and choice. So the proposed edit that you see there is in bold red. So the existing core value reads, in as where feasible and appropriate, depending on market mechanisms, to promote and sustain a competitive environment. And the suggested edit would be to add, that enhances consumer trust and choice. If you go down a little bit further, you will see that D from the affirmation of commitments talks about facilitating international participation in the DNS. There was a proposal from Robin to change the phrasing somewhat and to restate this as participate in international DNS coordination, but we didn't have a discussion as to where this edit as a whole or this might be incorporated into the bylaws, and I would welcome additional thoughts and inputs on that. If you go down to 4, yes, Steve, to your point, yes, that's correct. We did add global public interest, global to the public interest. If we go down to 4, there are a couple of elements in the affirmation of commitments that relate to transparency and accountability. And in particular, there are two, and the first one is in Article 4, which basically says that ICANN recognize that they must commit to performing and publishing analyses of the positive and negative effects of its decisions on the public, including any financial impact on the public and positive or negative impact on the systemic security, stability, and resilience of the DNS. This notion of performing impact assessments, it does not seem to be accounted for anywhere. And if that is not the case, and I'd very much appreciate someone telling me if it is accounted for somewhere, then proposing a new section in Article 3 of the bylaws on transparency, which would effectively take the language I just read out and insert that as a new section of Article 3, which is there in that, which is the red text that you see there. And continuing on to affirmation of commitments, Article 7, again, a suggestion for a new insertion in the transparency in Article 3 and the transparency in the bylaws. This is the affirmation of commitments paragraph for Article 7 in its entirety with a text suggestion by Robin. It makes for rather a long paragraph or new article, but it contains quite a number of points, but all of those points are actually very key to transparency and accountability as a whole. So that's the proposal for that second that one that you can see on your screen at the top of page three, that large proposed insert. If you carry on to Article 8, this deals with, again, A deals with maintaining capacity and ability to coordinate the Internet DNS at the overall level and to work for the maintenance of a single interoperable Internet. That language in various ways has already been incorporated into the bylaws, but Steve was suggesting that it might be valuable to incorporate it as a whole into the bylaws, but it's not clear to me where, so I would certainly value further thoughts on where they should be, where that might be inserted. The next one, B, 8B, is the issue of, it's a couple of issues here, one of which is remaining a not-for-profit corporation, headquartered, and then you've got the second concept of headquartered in the United States of America with offices around the world to meet the needs of the global community. The bylaws do not specify that ICANN should remain a not-for-profit corporation, but the articles incorporation do in a kind of indirect manner, obviously. So whether or not we need that incorporated somewhere, I think, is open for discussion. There was a suggestion in the group that the issue of jurisdiction be brought into the bylaws. From my recollection from our last discussion, that we didn't really conclude on that, but certainly there was a this now is being brought up at the broader CCWG level. So Mathieu has kicked off the discussion there. If you go to the next page, which is part C of Article 8, it's to operate as a multi-stakeholder, private-led organization with input from the public for whose benefit ICANN shall in all events act. This is interesting because the particular language there, multi-stakeholder and with input from the public for whose benefit ICANN shall on all events act, is not explicitly in the bylaw. And so the proposal is, as you'll see in the red there, to insert a new core value that would read as operating as a multi-stakeholder, bottom-up, thanks Robin, private sector-led organization with input from the public for whose benefit ICANN shall in all events act. That's where we are on that at the moment. So, Jordan, that's pretty much my report. Again, I would very much welcome further input on this and also suggestions as to how we take this forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Mathieu. That's very helpful. We've got a couple of hands up, so we'll deal with those first, and I assume you're available for questions. The first one is Malcolm. Malcolm, your hand is up.
Thank you, Jordan. And thank you, Mathieu, for that presentation. My comment and question is about the first change you propose here in 3A, the one about ensuring that the decisions made are made in the global public interest and accountable, transparent, and bottom-up in their formulation. When you presented this, Mathieu, you described this or presented this as the key change being that adding the tests that they must be bottom-up in their formulation. I'll say in passing, I support that. But it appears to me that the first bit has been changed as well, and I'd like you to confirm this. The ensure that decisions made related to the global technical coordination of DNS are made in the global public interest and other things it seems to me to be a broadening of how the term public interest is currently treated in the core values. Where it's only limited to specific questions at the moment. So my question, first of all, is that the correct understanding? Secondly, is that intentional? And then thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, would you intend that the board would be invited to set aside decisions or proposed policies that have been provided to it by the policy-making processes on the grounds that they viewed that a particular decision was not in the global public interest.
Malcolm, you're asking all the right questions. So, just to be absolutely clear, the language that is in the document, if you scroll up to 3A in black, is the language that exists at the moment in the affirmation of commitments. The proposed language...
But not in the core value statement.
The word
in the affirmation of commitments, but not in the core values in the bylaws.
It's in the affirmation of commitments. That's correct.
Yes.
So the proposed text, the proposal is to move that text with the following two changes: add the word global in front of public interest and add the words and bottom up in their formulation as you see it on the screen into the bylaws. So just to clear now, as to your second question or third question, which was how does this mean that is it an expanding of the scope? I'm not sure whether or not it's an expanding of the scope in terms of putting global in front of public interest. I think that's probably a debatable point. My question
wasn't about global in front of public interest. My question was more about moving it from the affirmation of commitments to the bylaws. Does that imply that the board would be invited or indeed required to prefer its view on the global public interest above, for example, the PDP?
It's a great question, Malcolm. I don't have an answer for you.
Thank you.
I just want to intervene on that point and suggest that it's one that's going to need to be raised in the discussions of Istanbul in a couple of places, Malcolm. One is where this interacts with the kind of community charter that Becky's team is working on. I think that some of these issues will end up in that part of the bylaws. I personally am pretty clear that we shouldn't be building a system where the board can use the excuse of the global public interest, quote-unquote, to undo policymaking that is grassroots and bottom-up. To me, that's always been my fear, that I can't start to use this language, that it provides a window for a certain set of actors to decide that they know best, which, if we fail in our accountability task, will have created a new monopoly that also thinks it knows best. But I'd be concerned if we were opening that up, and so I'd ask you to make sure that you raise that in Istanbul. Thanks for interrupting the speaking queue on that. The next speaker is Kabir. We definitely
yes,
can't
do you hear
you.
Me?
Oh, now we can hear you. Yep.
Yeah, is it okay? May I talk?
Yes.
In line,
it's
okay.
Your turn to talk.
If you can hear me, thank you very much for all. Something that I have noted in the entire current existing bylaw and affirmation of commitment, in many places, we said that I can, will do this, I can, will do that. I think because the bylaw is the highest level of the document, basic instrument of ICANN, the use of the word, deterministic word, will, would seem not to be appropriate. In other areas, they use the term shall, but not will. It is not up to the people to say that I will do this. The shall is obligations, but not will. Will deterministic. So I think this is something that I have read several times, and unfortunately, neither it has been appeared in any of the record, nor it has been taken into account. I don't think that we could say that ICANN will do that. ICANN is required to do something, and the appropriate verb is shall do that. This is number one. Number two, in many areas, the text which has been proposed in red, for instance, in B, in the section in C, it says that where feasible and appropriate, who will decide that it is feasible and who will decide that it is appropriate? It is too weak language we use. We have to put it a different way. Otherwise, it would not serve any purpose. Thirdly, we may put many things that we think is right, but we should look into the implementation of that. Something is good to put in there, but it is not implementable at all. How someone could ensure that something will be done? There is no guarantee for anything. So you cannot ensure that. That is something in many international treaties, it has been debated that the use of the verb ensure should be with a lot of caution, because it is sometimes it is difficult to ensure something. It is out of control of the people. I'm not criticizing anybody, anything, but I just give my experience that we have to be very careful and to make the use of the ensure to the minimum absolute necessary. Otherwise, it will be difficult. And in the bylaw, we have to avoid using where feasible as soon as possible, and so on and so forth, because all of them are qualification and require justification and would be difficult for implement. Please kindly, if possible, note that. And this is the last point is, I have seen in the ICANN core mission, some of these issues are there. Are we repeating them here, or the people dealing with the ICANN core mission, they will submit to your group the result of their work? I have seen somewhere similar sentence, and I hope that that would not be a repetition, and we have to take that into account. Thank you.
Thanks, thank you. Any response, Matthew?
Yes, I'm absolutely understood about the ambiguity and the weakness of the language. So just to be absolutely clear, what I have not done in this process is try to change the language of the existing bylaws, but merely to insert the key elements from the affirmation of commitment into the bylaws, either as in one case an edit or alternatively as two new bylaws. So just to be absolutely clear, I have not tried to change the existing bylaws. Now, maybe that's something we might want to do, but the problem is then I kind of see this as moving into, correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of moving into the work, Becky's work over in WP2, where there is this whole discussion of the compact, which and bylaws in the same kind of vein. So it, all I've done here is to try not to change the language, but to try and bring in existing language from the AOC. Thanks.
Thanks, Matthew. The next stand up is Steve DelBianco.
Thanks, Jordan. What Matthew's work has done and the discussion we just had with Cavus indicates the confusion that gets created about the destination for these affirmation of commitments items. The fact that the destination and core values led Matthew to simply repeat verbatim what the core values in the bylaws already say leads some of us to say, wow, what's that doing in there? But that is a bit beyond our scope for this particular exercise. Matthew's work, I think, leads us on work party one to examine the four paragraphs from the affirmation, to potentially rephrase them a bit, and then to recommend that rephrasing as well as the destination as to where it might live in the bylaws. Now, the discussion of where it might live in the bylaws is getting us a little bit confused, because it required you to cut and paste from the bylaws, and that may generate questions about, well, I didn't know that was in the bylaws, or that shouldn't be there. And if we undertake to modify things that have been in the bylaws for 15 years, our task is going to be a lot harder. So I think we should try to focus on what the affirmation said, and Matthew has that at the beginning of each section in black. The second thing is the potential rephrasing, you know, insertion of the word global in front of public interest, adding some phrases that Robin has suggested. And we should debate those. In Work Party 1, try to reach consensus within our work party about appropriate rephrasing or additional words. And the least of our worries should be where it goes in the bylaws, what section it goes. That could almost go later because it's clearly getting us off track right now. And I wanted to finally say that Malcolm raised what we'll call a threshold question. We should probably put it at the very top of the document. Threshold question is, does moving these from an affirmation, which is a bilateral agreement, to the bylaws, does that create a higher priority for ICANN to follow it? And in particular, having it in the core values section of the bylaws, does that convey more importance? Because as Malcolm said, there may be elements of the bylaws that are already conflicting today between PDP and other elements of the bylaws. We don't want to make that problem worse, but I'm pretty sure we didn't invent that problem, Malcolm. There are plenty of inconsistencies between the PDP process and obligations that are already in ICANN's bylaws. So I would just argue for us to stick to the rephrasing and don't worry so much about where it's going to go in the bylaws and raise Malcolm's question to the very top of the document as simply a threshold question. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. With your permission, Malcolm will move straight up, Matthew will move straight on to Greg's comment now.
Thanks, Greg Chatton, for the record. First, in responding directly to Malcolm's comment, or at least I think I am, in terms of PDP, or rather in terms of a recommendation, policy recommendation that has been passed to the board after being developed in a PDP, the bylaws have specific voting thresholds for the board to reject those. The board isn't really required to say, as far as I know, why it's rejecting them, although there's usually, you know, rationales that the board publishes for its decisions. And they could base those decisions on any core value that they want to, or not even on a core value, on any sort of thing that they want. And if they can't muster that that voting threshold then to vote it down, then it becomes a rule, and there's really no wiggle room around that, as far as I see. Second, with regard to the core values is kind of a weird section of these bylaws, and I'm not sure whether it's necessarily the right place for these things, although it may seem that it is the best place for them. The core values begins by saying that the following core values should guide the decisions and actions of ICANN. Should is not shall, and I follow Cavusa's line of thinking that these types of words are important. Should, shall, will, must, may, might. They all have different meanings. Should is not prescriptive. It's at best a recommendation. Secondly, the core values end with a paragraph that should be kept in mind if we're going to put anything in the core values. I'll read it kind of quickly and then post it in the chat. These core values are deliberately expressed in very general terms so that they may provide useful and relevant guidance in the broadest possible range of circumstances. Because they are not narrowly prescriptive, the specific way in which they apply, individually and collectively, to each new situation will necessarily depend on many factors that cannot be fully anticipated or enumerated. And because they are statements of principle rather than practice, situations will inevitably arise in which perfect fidelity to all 11 core values simultaneously is not possible. Any ICANN body making a recommendation or decision shall exercise its judgment to determine which core values are most relevant, how they apply to the specific circumstances of the case at hand, and to determine, if necessary, an appropriate and defensible balance among competing values. So this is, in a sense, even though the bylaws are more, are kind of the apex of the commitments or rules by which ICANN must live by, the core values themselves are kind of mushy in terms of the extent to which they bind ICANN. So we may be having the opposite effect that we expect by putting them in the core values. If we think we're binding ICANN, to something, putting it in the core values, is actually putting it into a pile of values that may or may not be applied depending on the circumstances. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. And that, to me, is why I've said a couple of times on the chat, the last thing we should be trying to do on this call today is work out exactly where these things should go to have the proper effect. We've already taken close to 45 minutes of our call, or just over, and we've gotten through one of the 8 docs we need to look at. So my proposal is that this is able to be forwarded to the Istanbul meeting, but that what we're trying to get across to that, what we want people to focus on, is that they should be included somewhere in the bylaws, and to focus a bit on whether these ideas ought to be captured in some kind of a binding way, wherever it is, and that the proposed changes from current text, wherever they end up getting reflected, are ones that are worth us discussing. I don't think we have time to go through and emerge to a consensus on every particular change. So if I look through it, I think this might, so let's not delay things by doing that. If anyone has a fundamental objection to this being an input to the discussion in Istanbul, then they should say so now. But I'd like us to proceed on that basis. Kavus, I see that your hand is up.
Yes, just no objection at all. But just I want to make this statement that I understand that still we are influenced and biased by the existing prevailing situation, that I can and the board has a lot of authority, whereas in future their authorities and their mandate are in hand of the community. So I don't think that we should put board should reject that, board should accept that, and so on and so forth. But this is to be taken into account. I'm sure that people are still biased by the existing situations, and we have to look into the future, that the board's authority will be diminished and will be transferred to the community. That is the community decision to reject or to accept, but not the board. So we always say, board accept that, board reject that. We should look at that one to see to what extent we should emphasize that board has the authority or has the power to reject. This should be limited to the minimum, and this authority should be given to the community. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Gavis. That's the character of the whole set of reforms we're proposing. I should say the other reason I'm relaxed about the timing is that even as we go out to community consultation, we're still going to be doing work as a CCWG and as working parties, presumably, on the detail, the workability, the interactions, the stress tests, and so on. So we'll have lots of time to pick up the issues that are being raised here. That's not to say they're not being helpfully raised. They are. So thank you, everyone, for that input. Matthew, I think you've got a few suggestions out of this to some caveat-style material and some guidance at the top of the doc for the CCWG's consideration. So I will suggest that you do that and recirculate as soon as you can. And on that basis, I'm going to quickly push us along to the next item, which is Malcolm's content on options in terms of removing the ICANN board. So if that doc could come up and if Malcolm could take the floor, that would be handy.
Okay, Jordan, if I had the floor. Okay, allow me to introduce this as briefly as I can manage. Jordan, you had produced a very useful paper describing how a community council might be given the power to discharge the board as a whole, and that community council might be able to and only able to exercise that power when petitioned by two SOs or ACs, i.e. one SO plus another SO or another AC or two ACs. That was your proposal. This Following the discussion, and as part of the discussion that we had at our last meeting, I thought that it would be useful to set out three broad ideas for what this power would mean and how it would be used. And so, and these became three straw men that I've got in this paper. And they envisaged three different concepts of what removing the board would be. The first one is your proposal, your original proposal. And it is the idea that the community has the right to spill the board, but it would need to reach a very high standard of consensus in, to do so, and indeed a high-level consensus even to begin the process of doing so. So in your proposal, it says that even to start to put it to the community council that the board should be spilled, you would need a consensus from not one, but two of the key stakeholder groups, BSOs or ACs, and bearing in mind that most of the ACs would not be likely to do this because they're advisory. And it struck me then, okay, well, that's one concept, the idea of spilling the board as a last resource power, a nuclear power, is one concept of how it might work. A second concept would be to take the same structure and mechanism that you've described and to say, yes, the community council could do this, and yes, it would require a very high threshold to spill the board. But it could be something that would have a lower threshold to ask the community council to do that. What would be the relevance of this change? It would be so as to ensure that the discussion around spilling the board happened within that process, so that instead of having to get to a very high level community consensus to spill the board before we even initiate the process, you could have a lower level to initiate it, and then you would have the discussion within the process as to whether or not that was appropriate, which would provide any the elements of the community with a venue, this community council, to have that discussion within, rather than forcing the community to have that discussion precedent to initiating that process. So here we've got, so there's the distinction between those two. On the one hand, you've got a high-level consensus to start the process. On the other one, you've got a significant element of the community being required, but by no means a consensus amongst the whole community to start this process. And then a high level, to, you need to then persuade a high level in order to actually spill the board. And the third straw man actually sets a lower boundary. It says the board ought to command the confidence of each element of the community to which it's responsible. And here this essentially means the three SOs. The board is accountable to those SOs, it serves those communities, and if any one of those communities cannot have confidence in the board, then maybe it's better to just simply elect a new board. And so the third straw man would allow any of the SOs to say, actually, you know what, it's just time for a new board. So these are three options. I'm not actually coming behind one of them. I'm identifying these as three different concepts for what this power might be that I think should be discussed, so that we could think, do we envisage this power to spill the board as a fundamental last resort, or, in the second place, as a broader mechanism to ensure that the community is able to, the board is responsive to the community, or in the third case, a strict requirement that the board must have the confidence of the communities to which it's answerable. That's the fundamental question I put, really, and then there's three straw men provide a mechanism for implementing each of those three principles according to which is chosen. Thank you.
Thanks, Malcolm. That's a nice, brief, but comprehensive introduction to the topic. Just let me make a couple of comments before we open a queue. So if you do want to make a comment or ask a question or anything, do start putting your hands up. I think that if we can, at some point we have to try and make the reading simple for the people who are going to be coming to the face-to-face, especially for work party two people who haven't been following our work easily. So I think it might be a good idea if we can try and thin out or separate these three straw man proposals, which I think are all worthy of discussion at Istanbul, so that it's not so cluttered up with the mechanism bits. I think that if we just focus on the power to remove the board and say that the mechanism used for straw man one and two would be the community council or a permanent CCWG or whatever comes out of the discussion later on in this call about ways to do stuff without mechanisms, then we can have an easy look at it. And it might, in fact, be easiest to just describe your three alternatives in a table that has nothing to do with the template, Malcolm. I'm prepared to spend some time working with you directly to do that, not at all to change the mechanisms, but just to create a kind of two- or three-page document that's easier to digest for people. If you're amenable to that, then we can just get on to do that after this call. But you don't need to answer that now, because first we'll take the speaking list and maybe we can come back to that comment. And the first person there is Kabuz, by the way.
May I talk?
Yes, in New Zealand English, fire away means go ahead.
Yeah.
I should just say go ahead.
I think the three options are good to maintain for the time being. Did I understand the third option would be some sort similar to the vote of confidence? The first option is the two major, I don't know, constituency, AEC or SO would initiate or would trigger the removal of the board. And the second option is the two steps, lower threshold, and then if it is agreed, go to the higher threshold. And the third option is the vote of confidence. Is that right, or I misunderstood the third option? Thank you.
That sounds right to me. Malcolm, is that a way to represent your straw man three?
Yes, straw man three was definitely a vote of no confidence by one of the SOs, and I would regard your original and the variant straw man option two as both being that the community council was the body that had half confidence in the board. In all cases, it seems to be a confidence vote.
Great, thanks. Are there any other comments here? Bearing in mind that we have yet to get onto our mechanism stuff, so that may shape it. Personally, I thought this was a very thoughtful contribution that will provide plenty of fodder for discussion next week. A couple of comments in the chat for the audio record. One is that if we did create a membership organization under California law, the members would automatically have the power to remove the board. So that's useful to know. We don't need to specify the power per se. We have a deficit of people on the speaking list, which is fine. Malcolm, are you happy to work with me to try and create a shorter, simpler version of this for people to read flying into Istanbul?
I'd be very happy to, of course. I had understood that in order to have this considered, I had to submit templates. But actually, if you look at the paper that I included at the beginning, an introduction section which described the differences between the three, because I thought that templates were less legible. I'd be happy to work with you to turn that into tabular format, but whatever is most useful to people to digest it so that we can stimulate the discussion. As I said in my introduction, I think really what we're talking about is what kind of outcome do we want, and then the implementation will follow from that quite easily.
Absolutely, and your contribution is helpful because it gets focused on those big picture questions. Steve, got the answer. Your hand is up.
Yes, it's a question we need to think about but not answer today on the call. Questions about spilling the board, which the BC brought up in May. Folks who were uncomfortable with that idea would say things like, well, if you spilled the board, ICANN would be unable to execute contracts, would be powerless to take decisions. It would cripple the organization. And I'd love to be able to respond to that by suggesting that the CCWG will, once we've got consensus that this power is going to be vested in some kind of community structure, that we would consult with legal experts to come up with continuing resolutions, sustaining powers, so that ICANN would still be able to execute its legal duties while we waited on new board members to be elected and designated from the respective bodies within the ICANN community. In other words, I don't think we need to solve that now, but just be aware when the question comes up, let's calmly answer that we believe that we can solve that, that the organization will not adopt new resolutions while the board is gone, but it ought to be able to continue to honor its legal obligations, sign documents and contracts that are pursuant to resolutions that were approved previously. That's all. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. This is a readily solvable problem. Every country that has democratic elections that involve a change of government has a good understanding of caretaker conventions, and I filled out some of those in my original removing the board matter. This is an easy problem to solve and isn't a sustainable opposition to the power that's proposed, but you're right, we will have to answer it. Sorry, I see Greg's hand up, and then hopefully we'll be able to move on to the next power. Greg.
I was just going to follow on that point and say that this is a perfect item to ask our legal counsel, once retained, for advice on. Clearly, boards don't get – if boards get spilled, there's not just anarchy that results. There is clearly a – there are systems in place for private boards are spilled, for how that's dealt with, and if in fact there is even a period during which there is no board. I think rather it's that a new general meeting gets called quickly, and that the board is the old board goes out and the new board, whoever it may be, comes in. But in any case, we're not, of all the things that we're discussing, it's probably one of the things that has the least need for us to get creative ourselves, and the most ability to draw on precedent from the real world out there. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Yeah, that's a fair point. Okay, I'm going to suggest then that we just, I think it's a case of adding a little summary table at the top or underneath the rationale. The prose is good to explain, as Keith noted. Now, let us move on to the next item on our agenda, and I'm going to call on Steve to talk about 3A. Unless the staff tell us that they haven't been able to put a PDF of that email from Steve. Here we go. Perfect. Okay, Steve, the floor is yours. And thank you, Malcolm, for that work.
Thank you, Jordan, and again, thank you, Malcolm. I appreciate that. Folks, apologies again for getting this in so late. It's something I committed to a week and a half ago, and I'm sorry that I only got to it today. So let's only take 4 minutes for this, for me to introduce the topic and get guidance from those of you on the call for two topics, for two questions in here. This was a task item called the community can require the implementation of all the accountability working groups Workstream 2 accountability improvements. You may recall from Frankfurt when we really started to solidify a decision between Workstream 1 and Workstream 2 that we said that things that we had powers, if Workstream 1 gave us the power to force the board to follow the community's will, well then not everything had to be done in Workstream 1. Once the powers were obtained by the community, it could use those powers to implement some of the other accountability improvements that might take longer to do, be more complex, and move those over to Workstream 2. We were all pretty comfortable with that, and I documented in the email today, what is on the screen for you now, I documented the definition that we had arrived at as a consensus for Workstream 1 versus Workstream 2. This was in late December. The discussion on this is that in Workstream 1, it's possible that we as the CCWG could come up with a list of all the Workstream 2 items. It's one thing to come up with them on a list like a mind map. It is quite another thing to have implementation details all fleshed out at the time of transition. And I think the chances of that are relatively remote. So what I've written here on the second page is that at the time of transition, not all of the improvements will be defined in sufficient detail to begin implementation. So more work is needed. Now, if some of the items for Workstream 2, which is a post-transition accountability improvement, if some of those items are pretty well fleshed out in great detail, we can write all that down and put it on a piece of paper and show it to ICANN board and have them adopt a resolution committing the organization to implement those items within a specified time period subsequent to transition. Because we've already done our work and we're handing it to the board and saying, commit to this and under a certain time frame. Now, that commitment would need to be signed while we have the leverage of the transition hanging over ICANN. And the commitment could include a means by which we could enforce that commitment. If we didn't have a means to enforce the commitment, then 2 years after the transition, we haven't implemented half of the Workstream 2 items, we could use the powers that Malcolm has just presented for spilling the board. That's one example. The second and final part of this is, what about items on Workstream 2 where the implementation details, and again, most of this call has been about the details. The details are tough to work out. So if Workstream 2 details aren't done, well, the community has to finish its work. So it's not as if you can put those on a list and have ICANN's board commit to implement, because we're not done with the bottom-up consensus-based process of working out how these Workstream 2 mechanisms would work. So it would be in our hands to do the work. The community itself, all of us on this call, all the groups we work with, would have to finish the work of specifying the details for some of these Workstream 2 accountability improvements. And when we finish, and that's on our clock, right? We control that clock. When we finish, we'd have something that was ready to be put for public comment and then handed to the board to say, here it is, implement it now. We may need a separate mechanism to force the board to implement a Workstream 2 accountability mechanism a year or 2 years from now after we've finished all the hard work of laying it out. Now, this is not a problem in isolation. We deal with this now when and Aubrey's on the line. She knows how this works. The ATRT, the Accountability Transparency Review Team, comes up with reports and recommendations that get approved by the board. We've done two ATRTs already. And then it takes a great deal of time for the board to implement some of those items. Now, we rely on this, the next ATRT, to point out what hasn't been implemented and tell ICANN work harder. But we don't have a general purpose mechanism of forcing the implementation of bottom-up consensus recommendations, whether they arose from an AOC review or maybe even a PDP or other processes that satisfy the bottom-up multi-stakeholder process. So the question I pose there at the very final part of my document is that should we come up with a new community power that is strictly confined to just the Workstream 2 items that are fleshed out after transition, or do we need a more permanent and general community power that forces the implementation of consensus items outside of that which is already sort of covered in a PDP, another kind of a process? So I'll stop there and take a cue. I see Aubrey first.
Hi, Aubrey speaking. One question about this. In other words, I assume that relying on this stuff being implemented relies on the Workstream 1 stuff having been implemented. And if the Workstream 1 stuff, as has been described, has been implemented in terms of community vetoes and spilling boards and any other mechanisms that we're putting in place, doesn't that cover this issue that the community makes a recommendation, the board doesn't do it, and we go into the other mechanisms. I'm not quite sure I understand why the mechanisms that we're inventing for guaranteeing community oversight at Workstream 1 don't cover the advent of these issues. I had always thought that that was sort of connected. Thanks.
May I respond, Jordan?
Yep.
Aubrey, the community powers that we've been discussing so far mostly have to do with challenging or vetoing things like a budget, a board decision, a management decision. What happens when we need to motivate action as opposed to challenge or veto a board action? We haven't talked very much about how one forces the board to take an action, short of the nuclear option, where the community sends a letter to the board and says, please implement what you promised to implement. And if the board refuses, well, we go to spill the board. And all of us are attempting to find intermediate ways that are short of, say, the nuclear option. Alan Greenberg, while we were in Frankfurt, suggested that, for instance, if there's a specific power on the Work Party 1 community power list that says that recommendations that came through a affirmation of commitments review team are special and thereby deserve a new community power, whereby the community with a supermajority could force the board to implement something that it had not yet implemented. And I think that comes close, Aubrey. But what about items that have nothing to do with an AOC review team? For instance, a Workstream 2 item that we spend months developing, we put it in Workstream 2, and then a year from now, ICANN hasn't begun the implementation of a particular item. I don't know what power, short of spilling the board, enables us to force them to take action.
Thanks, Steve. I think that if I could insert myself in the speaking list, I think mine was the next hand up, wasn't it?
It is.
Sorry, I just lost Adobe Room connectivity. But it's back. I've got three thoughts here. One is that depending on the timing of our processes and whether we really are going to send the final proposal through in June, or whether we're going to have to do a round of consultation over the ICANN meeting, we may have more stuff specified for the Workstream 2 that allows us to be more determinative and give a more comprehensive list to get ICANN to commit to as part of the transition. The second point is I really think that we should almost treat this as a stress test. I can't remember whether it is one or not, and I apologize if I haven't absorbed that deep in what you said. That we need to test our set of mechanisms once we've kind of settled down on them to see whether they can do as Avery suggested, guarantee the implementation. If they can't, I do think that one option that we should consider is the creation of a specific limited purpose PDP for Accountability Workstream 2 that kind of empowers this CCWG to make that set of recommendations once the charter and organizations have adopted it. The board would have to implement it unless there was a very high supermajority against it. So there's already kind of option that's already clear in what we're doing here. And I don't think this would ever become a board spilling thing that I'm not keeping up with the chat. So I think we should test whether this is necessary once we've got a better picture of the recommendations. And if further steps are necessary, we should design them. That's my view.
Jordan, if I may ask a little bit of clarification.
Yeah.
I propose two steps here. The first step was that for anything that we as the CCWG have consensus and community support for that falls into Workstream 2, we would write it all down and obtain a commitment prior to transition with at least a deadline in it where ICANN would commit the resources and the management expertise to implement. And you're suggesting that if it takes us a little longer to get to transition, we'll have more time to put together the implementation details. So there, that could be an extensive list of Workstream 2 items. But are you suggesting everything has to make it to that commitment list? Because
no,
I'm still believing we still have a couple of items that won't. Yeah, go ahead.
I think that it's unlikely to, because the Workstream 2 stuff is meant to take a much broader look at ICANN-SERVOL accountability. And mm-hmm. so I don't think the difference of a month or two would give us an answer that we could write down a detailed list.
So you do think we need two steps. We need a commitment list as well as some other power to compel, or like Avri, do you believe that the ultimate power to compel is to spill the board, and that ought to suffice?
No, I don't believe that spilling the board is the ultimate power. I think that we will have some things we can write down and seek a commitment to implementing. I think there will be some other things that we end up developing in Workstream 2, and I think it's a stress test of our Workstream 1 work to work out whether we're going to be able to require it to be implemented or not. If we think, on our best judgment, that we can't require Workstream 2 to be seriously considered and implemented, then I think we might have to look at designing another mechanism. But certainly, I do not think that removal of the ICANN board for quibbling with details around a second round of enhancement is a viable way to treat this. I just don't think the community could go there.
Jordan,
not an objective one.
Got it. So, Jordan, with respect to the second half of what you said, as I noted in the second to last paragraph, one of the Work Party 1 items is called 2C. And that was the one that Alan mentioned in Frankfurt, the notion that the community could have the power to force management and the board to implement an AOC recommendation. And if that were expanded, that might be the easiest place to say not only to require the implementation of an AOC recommendation, but to require the implementation of an accountability improvement that was under the consensus of a Workstream 2 item as part of the transition. By adding that phrase in there, we would be able to piggyback off of an existing community power called WP1-2C. And I haven't read the text for that yet. I don't know that that's been discussed.
It would be helpful if, in the terms of simplicity, if we were building on something that we'd already done. So, yeah. I also just should say I don't think we need to discuss this any further right at this point. I think the material that you've prepared provides a sound basis for a conversation at the assembly meeting. So if people are happy with that, and I don't see any more hands up, can we move on to the next item on the agenda? Which we will do, which is the work that Keith has been doing on 5D 1 and 2. Keith, are you ready to present that to us?
Yep, I am, Jordan. Can you hear me okay?
I can, yep. Could you just bear in mind, I'm trying to do it, if we can speak a little bit slow and collectively, that would be helpful for the non-first English speakers on the call.
Yes, thank you, Jordan. And I noted Kavus's comments in the chat as well, so I will attempt to do so. So if we could put these, the table for WP1-5B1 on the screen, the first one. And I don't think we need to go through both of these templates, Jordan, because they're very, very similar. In effect, these are two possible solutions for securing the same thing. And I can talk to the differences, but I think we only need to go through one of the templates in the interest of time. So the first, 5B1, both of these, the goal is to prevent ICANN from imposing obligations, new obligations that are outside the scope of a traditional policy development process. And I will also note that in the ICANN community today, we are, there's already a working group focused on sort of the distinction between policy and implementation. So this, I think this whole subject is not only about policy, but it's about ICANN's ability to interpret policy recommendations and to make determinations on the implementation and really what those impacts are to the community. So let me just tee this up, I think, at a high level, and then we can go through the table. At a high level, you know, the bylaws that we've been discussing have several components in the early sections: mission, values, powers, and restrictions. And I think what we're talking about here in 5B, whether it's 1 or 2, is a restriction. And it's probably a non-triggered restriction. So the two choices that we have for restricting ICANN's ability to impose new obligations would be through either an accountability contract, so some sort of contractual mechanism, presumably with the contracted parties, registries, registrars, and as a flow down, the registrants, who also have to accept the terms of a registration agreement, or the possibility of having a bylaw provision that accomplishes the same thing. So we're really looking at two options to try to restrict ICANN's ability to impose new obligations. So let me stop there and see if anybody has any questions before we get into the detail. Carlos, I see your hand, please.
Yes, thank you very much. That is a good point, but we would be, I would be very happy if we introduce two more words, directly or indirectly impose obligations, because they may be directly imposing or maybe indirectly. Indirect imposition is the way that you mentioned by interpretation. We should remove any power of interpretation of anything from the board. Interpretation is the community, but not the board. So we should say directly or indirectly impose obligations. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Kavusa. I agree. I think that's a very important distinction. So thank you for that recommendation. And I think perhaps we can talk in a little bit of detail about sort of how this could be impacted or how it could be affected. So, for example, let's just use one example with the accountability compact or contract, is that that could be accomplished through amendments to the existing registry agreement, registrar accreditation agreement, or registration agreement, which is the one that registrants accept when they register a domain name. And the idea is that if there's not something, if something does not come through an established community process, a policy development process, then this would be a new restriction that explicitly prevents ICANN, both staff and board, from imposing new obligations on, in a sense, the contracted parties. But I think this has a bigger scope than just the contracted parties. In a sense, the contracted parties would be the mechanism that ICANN would use to introduce new obligations, potentially on end users, potentially on the entire community. And I think that's something that we need to be very careful about, and I think what we're seeking to prohibit. So the question is, do we restrict ICANN's ability to do so through new contractual language that clearly prevents them from doing things outside of a PDP or outside of an existing process, or do we look to incorporate something into the bylaws? So I see Kavus has asked, could someone kindly describe or mention what do we mean by compact? Yeah, Kavus, thank you. I think it's a contractual document, and it's a good question, and I've noted this in some of the later parts of the template, is how would you enforce such a thing? If it's outside of the existing registry, registrar, and registrant agreements, how would it be enforced? And if it's a bylaw amendment, who is in the position of being counterparty to that? Where is the restriction? Where are the teeth? And I think those are very, very good questions. So, Jordan, if I may, why don't we go through the template fairly quickly, and then I'll be more than happy to take questions. So let me go on. So if we look at the template before us, and I assume everybody has scroll control, the top line is a question, what's the description? And this would be a new restriction to prevent ICANN from expanding its mandate through the unilateral addition of new obligations or requirements on registries, registrars, and registrants. And there is some language in the existing registry agreements, for example, and the registrar agreements for the GTLDs. And this is an important distinction as we talk this through, is that, you know, GTLD registries and registrars have agreements in place, but many CCTLDs do not. And so that's another consideration for us as we look ahead, figuring out exactly how we would implement such a thing and why it may make more sense to have a bylaw provision rather than trying to rely on contractual relationships. But let's hold that for later. And again, you know, I don't want people to think that this is only impactful on contracted parties, registries, registrars, and registrants. As I said before, the registries and registrars and registrants might be the mechanism through which I can potentially abuse power down the road, but it could be very impactful to others in the community, the users and those that rely on you know, the use of the domain names. So I think this is a check and a balance. You know, this new restriction would ensure that ICANN cannot use its position to unilaterally impose new requirements on its contracted counterparties, including registrants. It ensures that ICANN must rely on established processes to develop and implement new or amended policies that are necessary for the secure and stable operation of the DNS. And it ensures multi-stakeholder community is responsible for developing consensus policies within predictable and transparent bottom-up processes. And that role cannot be circumvented by ICANN management, you know, staff or board. Okay. I think, again, there's the question, is the mechanism triggered or non-triggered? I think it's non-triggered, although it would probably need to have some sort of a trigger or a connection if it were violated, you know, for enforcement, you know, for penalty. So I think through a new accountability contract with registries, registrars, and registrants, this would be a new non-triggered mechanism. It could be a new standalone agreement, or it could be incorporated into existing agreements. Okay, possible outcomes. A new accountability contract would give the community powers to constrain an ICANN staff or board that attempted to expand its mandate beyond accepted borders through the addition of new requirements on contracted parties and registrants. In breach of the accountability contract or bylaw provision, depending on which way we go, by ICANN would constitute grounds for reconsideration and redress. And again, we would need to make sure that the hooks were there into the other things that are being developed in our community work to make sure that, you know, that things are connected in such a way that if there was a violation of something like this, that other mechanisms would be in place to handle the to handle that. Let's see, conditions of standing. This is an important question. So contracted parties, if we're looking at an agreement, you know, as part of a contract, it would have to be the counterparty, right? Most likely, anyway, that would have the power to trigger the mechanism if needed. And I think clear and concise language would be very important and potentially act as a deterrent on ICANN unilaterally imposing new obligations, either through, you know, sort of edicts or interpretation, or, you know, importantly, you know, you could imagine two parties to a contract, ICANN and a registry, for example, negotiating terms in a bilateral way and moving forward with implementation that doesn't necessarily have the consensus support of the community. So again, I think this for people who are not contracted parties, it's important to make sure that there is a prohibition about things that really are grounded in policy or should be considered a policy issue, not being able to simply bilaterally negotiate something without the input of the multi-stakeholder community. Again, this is balance. This is making sure that there's accountability throughout the community. So let me stop there. I don't want to drone on. There's more that we can go through, and we will, but I want to stop and see if there's any questions at this point.
Okay. Thank
Anyone?
You. Any questions? We've got a hand up from Steve. So if you don't mind, Keith, I'll get you to do this round of questions.
Sure.
And I'll hand it over to you.
Yeah, happy to do it, Jordan. Thanks. Steve, go ahead.
Hi, Keith. I put this into the chat because a lot of times we react
to what's been going on in the new GTLD program, where we as a community approved a guidebook, or commented on a guidebook, we didn't actually vote on it, on a guidebook that created these sort of bilateral negotiations that resulted in obligations showing up on the laps of registrars, registrants, et cetera, that never had a basis in policy, and I understand that. In some cases, my group, the business constituency, was in favor of some of those obligations. So I ask in the chat, this key question is that if the next round developed another guidebook, and the guidebook contained mechanisms for these bilateral negotiations between, say, government objectors and aspiring registries, that party might agree to a contract that required them to impose obligations that had no basis in developed policy. What's your feeling about whether guidebooks could go outside and beyond the bylaws or the contract, as you say, or does this contract govern everything such that guidebooks could not grant new powers? Guidebooks could not go beyond what the contract says is the limit. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Stephen. It's a good question, and I think this raises the point about, do you have to set limits? Are there parameters or are there borders or limits to what such a contract or a bylaw amendment would allow for? And I think that's definitely, I don't know that I necessarily have the answer for that today. I think it is something worth discussing further. I mean, my feeling here is that we have a structure where policies are developed in the GTLD space, and if there's a consensus policy that comes out of that process, then contracted parties to ICANN are required to implement them. And I think that's a very healthy thing. It has largely served the community well. It provides some predictability to contracted parties who are primarily businesses that need some level of predictability, but it provides the community the ability to make changes. And I know I'm telling you things that you already know, but it provides the community the ability, if needed, and provided there's community consensus, to make changes to the contracts. FICUIS is a perfect example in today's world, where the community came together and said, we want everybody to be FIC, and the policy was approved, and it will be implemented. So, but I think what we're seeing and what we've seen in the last couple of years is an increasing gray area or an expanding gray area as it relates to contract interpretation and policy interpretation and how that impacts the implementation of policies and where things may be approved or implemented in ways that are different than what the community expected. So I think it makes sense for us to try to be as specific and concise and clear as possible as to what exactly we're talking about. And I think that work is still ahead of us. And I think that is something that we'll need to do. But whether this would be an overriding document that would forever prevent the ability to be variation in the future, I don't know that it necessarily needs that, but I think the key is for the community to be in a position of saying, you can't simply go off and interpret something unilaterally. You can't interpret something unilaterally. You can't implement something unilaterally through imposing new contractual interpretations on contracted parties. And again, this flows down. I think the impact of this flows down to other participants in the community. Sorry, I rambled on there. I hope that answered the question. And if not, I'm happy to take other questions. So I see Malcolm and then Cabos.
So, sorry, can I just interrupt as well? Can I just interrupt? Sorry. We've got 25 minutes left on the call and another 4 or 5 templates to get through. So we really need to kind of speed up if we can. Thanks. So yep. Concise question, quick answer.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Jordan. And, what I would suggest is that rather than going through this and, the rest of the template, there's not a whole lot left. Let's have the last couple of questions, encourage people to read this, and then we can talk about it in more detail in Istanbul. So, Malcolm, over to you.
Keith, thank you very much. This is a very important point, and it's a very useful contribution. I'm going to make my comment as quickly as possible, given the time. I'd say this looks very good. But speaking as a non-contracted party, I would wonder if a contact mechanism is the best mechanism for bringing this about, rather than, for example, something in a scope statement in the bylaws that would be capable of one of the review and redress mechanisms we're looking at in the other WP. Or maybe it would be both. Maybe it would be doing that and then also implementing it in the contract so that contractor parties could implement it through the through the mechanism that you're envisaging, while non-contractor parties would have another mechanism for implementing the same or exercising the same concerns. So I think we need to look at that side of it, but this is a great discussion to be having, and I'd like to look at what the best mechanism for carrying this forward is. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Malcolm. This is Keith for the record. I agree completely, and I certainly had not – I don't have a strong opinion on which option to use or to rely upon or, as you said, maybe a hybrid. And I do think it's important to make sure that, you know, any impacted party has the ability to weigh in. I take your point, and I welcome that. Thanks. Kavus, over to you.
Yes. Maybe it is a point for yourself, Jordan, or for any other colleagues. How we could ensure that no provisions in the bylaw is subordinated by any item of the guidebook? Unfortunately, sometimes we subordinate that to the guidebook provisions, which is not correct. Guidebook is a guidebook, that's all. It's quite lower case and hierarchical steps with respect to the provisions of the bylaw. How we could mention or how could clarify that in the bylaw? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Carlos.
I'll just say that's an important implementation question that we need to make sure we cover up.
Yeah.
And just leave it at that if we could, Keith.
Yep, I'm done. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you for your wonderful work here. Sorry, all, that I glossed through the focus. I had a couple of distractions in the room here, and I fear I've let us get well behind in the time we need. So I'm not aware of any other work items that we need to discuss in terms of the powers. I'd like us to move on to the mechanisms if we could. And I would like us, I'm determined that we finish on time. I've certainly got another meeting, 22 minutes. I'd like us to go through stuff that we're probably least familiar with, which would be the statutory delegates and members' content from Edward first, if we can. And then I'd like to lapse into the CCWG and existing SOAC structures. But given that we're all familiar with those mechanisms already, I personally will be a little bit more relaxed if we haven't discussed them on this call, and we'll do an email round of comments if we don't get to them. So the first question is, Edward, are you on the call, and are you available to present the statutory?
I'm here, Jordan, and perfectly happy to go forward. Can we get the templates on the screen?
I would think so, yeah.
Okay, that would be helpful.
Alice, is that on the way?
Yes, I'm working on it. Sorry.
Well, I can actually start with delegates because, well, first of all, the templates themselves, a lot of boilerplate language that Roloff imported from stuff he's done before. So we'll sort of ignore that in the interest of time. Let me start with delegates because delegates are fairly simple. And I'll actually just quote to the first line of the California statute that creates delegates. A corporation may provide in its bylaws for delegates having some or all of the authority of members. So basically what that means is delegates are sort of like a cafeteria-style membership scheme. We can pick and choose the powers granted to members under the membership scheme and call them delegates and work it that way. If we go membership, we have to take everything, good and bad. So what's up there now? Okay, Alice, if you could get to the membership scheme, because as you can see, actually, to keep the delegates up there, is the mechanism triggered or non-triggered? You can see where we have put, it's the first one, description. The California Corporation Code allows for designation of delegates which have some or all of the power of members. So if we go with the delegate scheme, we can pick and choose the powers that the statutes give members, but we don't have to take all of them. If we choose membership, we have to take the whole kit and caboodle. So if we could get the membership template up there, please, Dallas, I'd appreciate that. The one thing that you need to realize about these two mechanisms compared to others we've looked at is these are based on the California corporate code. We don't have the flexibility to creative and design exactly what we want. And that's particularly true in terms of membership. A lot of what we've been debating, thresholds for filling the board, for example, if we choose a membership scheme, those are in the statute. We don't have the option of saying we want a super majority to fill a board. We want to do X, Y, and Z. These are all creations of statute, and we have to take it as it's given to us. Now, in terms of what powers members have, first, what are members? Members can be designated in the bylaws. They can be natural or legal people. They can be, Keith, you can be a member. The IPC can be a member. You don't have to be incorporated. It can, and we just, again, we have to designate that in the statutes. Members have the ability to adopt, amend, and repeal bylaws under 5150 and 5812 of the California Corporate Code. Members can remove any and all members of the board of directors. However, we can't set the threshold ourselves. The threshold comes in with the statute. So, for example, if we have less than 50 members, board of director members are removed by a simple vote of the majority of the membership. We cannot have any other threshold. It comes with the statute. I should also note that under a different part of the corporate code, members elected by a specific subgroup of members can only be removed by that specific subgroup. So we cannot have a spill the board type thing. We can have a spill the board, providing that the member, that the board of director member that has been elected by a specific subgroup is also spilled by that subgroup. There's a AGM requirement. Members do have the ability to inspect records. If you recall Kyle Auerbach's lawsuit a decade or so ago, members don't have the power of a member of the board to inspect records, but we can take a look at the financial records, for example. That's in the statute. Members elect the board of directors, and there's some flexibility in how we design the election, but it's generally a majority vote. You can have subgroups electing members of the board. The final power, which to me, we've talked about the nuclear option, about filling the board, disagree. The nuclear option, were we to go to a membership or a delegate scheme and included this in the delegate, for example, in the delegate powers of the delegates, we went that way, is the power of the derivative lawsuit. And what a derivative lawsuit is it gives each member the ability to sue the corporation, specifically the board or a member of the board, as the, on behalf of the corporation for failure to act for the benefit of the corporation. So it would allow each and every member, if the board were to be captured, for example, it would allow members to file suit and regain control of the board in that way, and not only spill the board, but to hold the board or individual members thereof liable for their actions. The costs, I do want to point out the costs. If we go to a membership scheme, I would suggest it would be the interest of members to have some sort of liability insurance that probably should be provided by ICON. They are not liable for the for what the corporation does, or liabilities of the corporation. But particularly in the States, there are things called slap lawsuits, which are basically frivolous suits, but members could be exposed to them, and we'd have to make sure that there's no out-of-pocket there. And also, if we're going to have derivative lawsuits, the state of California would require up to a $50,000 bond in order to file the suit, and we'd have to deal with that as well. So that's basically what the membership scheme would entail. On the good side, it solves our problems. A lot of the issues we've been debating, we're given the solutions. On the bad side, it solves our problems. We may not want the solutions they provide. Thanks.
Thank you, Edward. This is a good run-through. I appreciate it. thank you to you and Rulof for doing the work. Are there any comments or questions regarding this? I see no hands up. I see some typing.
well, we're waiting, Jordan. One thing I did want to mention, something that has come out of the legal subgroup and talking to the law firms we're thinking about engaging, there may be other mechanisms that we're not considering as a community right now, and we need to leave ourselves open for the advice from the attorneys is they may lead us into a different direction than anything we've ever thought of. And one firm in particular has sort of stimulated thought in this regard, but we have to wait until we see who we go with.
Thanks, Ed, and I agree. This is one of the issues that's the timing concern that Robin and others have raised, that we don't know what we don't know yet, and it's going to take a lot of advice and thinking to get there. But we are.
I do notice Steve's question, and I actually rushed through delegates. And as I was saying, Steve, you think of delegates as membership, cafeteria style membership, that we can pick and choose which powers in the statutes that apply to membership, and we call them delegates, but we don't have to take all the powers that are given to members in the statute. But I should also note, there was a question raised by the Jones Day attorney in Singapore as to whether you can have delegates without first having members. He thinks you can, I think you can, but it's certainly something we'll need to clear with counsel if we're going to try to go down the delegate route.
Yeah.
Steve has written, so delegates can be just as powerful as members, but only for powers we choose to allow, and we can specify the rules. You can specify the rules in terms of which powers you give delegates, but, for example, you can't change the threshold issue, as I understand it. But, again, we want to clear that with counsel.
And for those forms, we can incorporate other powers that are beyond the statutory ones and vest them in members or delegates, as long as they're not inconsistent with the statutory powers, right?
Yes, true.
Yeah. Okay, my instinct is that this is important and useful advice to get through for the Istanbul meeting as part of our portfolio of mechanisms. No, Steve, you're wrong. We couldn't have a spill the board threshold that was different to the one set out in the statute. My understanding, anyway, is that if there's a power set out in the statute, you can't modify it by means of your bylaws.
We chose not to give delegates the power. I believe you can, but it would have to be formulated properly. We just wouldn't import that portion of the membership scheme and had to create one of our own. I believe that's possible. But again, it's hard. I did a Westlaw search. I cannot find a delegate-based corporation, nonprofit corporation in California. It's not a common form of organization.
Okay. That leads to another question to the legal advisors, which, of course, is if there isn't, you know, what's the stability of the California nonprofit corporate code? Is it likely to be removed from us at any point? But these are lawyer questions and implementation ones. Can I assume then that people are happy with this as an interesting discussion starter and the conversation we've had is useful? It's got people thinking. And we should agree that this is going to be available to the CCWG for the meeting and move into the next template. Are people okay with that approach, bearing in mind the time that we've got? Don't see any hands. I too would love to discuss this for a full hour, but we just have to get a little refresh so the people have a chance to just review at a high level the other things here. So actually, this one will be really quick on my part. This is the community council mechanism that had been set out in the bylaws that had been set out in the template I did to the board of directors. It was never my intention that community council would only be used for removing the board, that it could provide a general purpose mechanism. So all this template does is take out the references to board of directors as specific powers, and that's why there's a lot of non-applicable here, because all the stuff about the specific powers is not relevant at this point. If you scroll through the template, you see that. I've kept the options in terms of composition the same, and the diversity stuff the same. On page 2, on page 3 have suggested the same independence requirement. I've adjusted the appointment, election or appointment process slightly. I think I've just abbreviated it, kept the one-year term. And in terms of accountability, I've just added a bullet point. This is on the bottom of page 4. Previously, it had been suggested that you could give a warning, a formal warning to a member that you'd appointed and then proceed to remove them after 30 days. If we went for this model, it would probably be important to make sure that in each power, there was some specification about whether a member could vote on various decisions if they're in receipt of formal warning in that 30-day notice period, because otherwise you're creating a situation where for exceptional powers like removing the board, if an SO has decided that a member isn't representing their views, they could still pass to vote on it. So that's just an amendment to cover this. And the rest is pretty much the same, not applicable. Steve asked a very sensible question. The chat, which is, what is the difference between this and a permanent CCWG? And my answer to that is that I don't know, because there's no such thing at the moment in ICANN as a permanent CCWG. And a CCWG is established by its chartering entity and can be disestablished by them. It's usually established for a specific period, for a specific task. I think in practical terms, this community council might be the same thing as a CCWG, a permanent CCWG. But my suggestion would be that we just quickly, because what we've just looked through is existing material that you've seen before, why don't we go through Working Party 1-B, the permanent CCWG, and just see what I suggested there. Can we do that one, Alice?
Hello?
I'm just sorry. Yes, I shouldn't be waiting, but it's obviously not happening. I was hoping that staff could put up the document for 1B, but we're running out of time. So I think, Steve, your question is there a difference? The difference seems to me to be in the way that such groups are constituted. Here we go. So here's the permanent cross-community working group model. Standing body chartered by the SOs and ACs, representing the community. The powers that were granted to this would need to be given to it in the bylaws, I think, because otherwise it doesn't count as permanent. If it's just a chartered organization like a normal CCWG is, then it can be unchartered and removed. And then there'd be no community vehicle to implement the powers, and we would have failed to solve any accountability issues. So if you scroll down this template onto page 2, I've proposed a default of the same size with the same composition as the previous document, as the previous model of the community council, just for ease. I'm not trying to prejudge that decision. I'm just trying not to double think it. We'll have the debate about it in Istanbul. I did have a specify an alternate that, like our current CCWG on accountability, we could just allow each chartering organization to appoint between 2 and 5 members. If we did that, it would have to be very clear what the voting procedures were for each power, but we'd still have the collection of people available to discuss these issues. I also left in the notion that a current office holder in an SO and AC shouldn't be a member, but I've highlighted it because that might be a different point in a CCWG. And I've changed the election appointment process to say that, as with all other CCWGs, except the discretion of the SOs and ACs, but that I'm proposing there should be an active reappointment or appointment of a new person on an annual basis, just to prevent this turning into a group of old hands who are too familiar with each other and with the corporation. That wouldn't be helpful. There's nothing new there other than the implementation point that was already made, that it would need to be in the bylaws. And I don't know whether that leads it to the CCWG or whether it turns it into a community council. And Robin suggests that a CCWG is a civic forum delegate. In the end, it's my hope. I've got, I don't know about the rest of you, but I've got 22 hours of plane time between here and Istanbul. And there's the suggestion of a table that looks at some characteristics of these members and sets of these mechanisms and sets them out side by side for easy comparison. I'm happy to undertake to spend some time on the plane preparing such a table, and that would hit your email list on Saturday the 21st in the afternoon UTC. Now, that's too late in theory for us to formally consider it at the CCWG, but given it will be an organization of existing material, I think that the co-chairs might let us look at it. So I see one hand up, which is Kavuz. If I could just take Kavuz's call and then we'll wrap this up. Kavuz, please go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry to raise this question. We refer to the ICANN regional distribution. This is not a balance distributions. If you take one region as only two or three countries, and the other region 75 countries. So I don't think that we should stick too much on this ICANN regional distribution unless we redefine the region. It is something very, very old and based on some other non-technical issues and non-administrative. There has some other origin. I don't want to get to that details, but I don't think that it is advisable to go ahead with the regional ICANN regional distributions because there is totally imbalance. Thank you.
Okay. Yep, that's a fair point to make, and it's one that we'll no doubt be talking about in Istanbul. Look, I'm really sorry that we've run out of time, folks, but we have. We've had a very useful set of discussions, I think, on this call that's given everyone who has been drafting some final thoughts. I personally, as rapporteur, am going to be...
Hello? Hello?
I think we lost Jordan.
Well, it sounded like he was closing the call out anyway.
I guess we can all say goodbye to each other without Jordan's help.
Hi, all. Can you hear me again? Sorry.
Sorry.
Just a point to wrap up. I think my audio is working now.
Yeah.
We just need to wrap the call. Thank you all for the work. If you've got any amendments to make, it would be very helpful if they can be sent through in the next 18 hours or so. And I will undertake to get all, to make sure that with staff all the information is on the wiki, and to prepare a kind of reading list for people that identifies the specific documents that they need to see. Thanks everyone for good work, and any remaining issues, please raise them on the list or with me straight away. Thank you, everyone.
Great. Thanks, Jordan.